young woman.
It's an accountant you need, not a bloody lawyer, and if you don't get something sorted out soon, there won't be any business left at all. Balderdash! Stick to your mumming, you shrieking virago. Here, Trembler, there's a customer in the shop.
A little wizened man ran anxiously out with the air of one ducking away from flying bullets. He shut the door behind him, but the shouting continued.
Yes, miss?
Came a nervous voice from behind his huge soup-strainer moustache. I came to see Mr. Garland, but if he's busy... She looked at the door, and he cowered away from it as if expecting some missile to come hurtling through.
You don't want me to go and fetch him, do you, miss?
He pleaded.
I daren't, honest.
Well, no, I suppose not at the moment.
Was it about a sit-in, miss? We can fit you in any time.
He was looking at an appointment book. No, it was... The door opened, and the little man ducked under the counter.
Be damned to the whole tribe!
Came in a roar from the photographer, and then he stopped at once. He stood in the doorway and grinned, and Sally realized that she'd forgotten how full of life and movement his face was.
Hello,
he said, in the friendliest possible manner. Miss Lockhart, isn't it? He was suddenly propelled into the shop, and there in his place stood a young woman 2 or 3 years older than Sally. Her red hair flared over her shoulders, her eyes blazed, and she held a sheaf of papers in her clenched fist. Sally thought, but she's beautiful. And so she was, astonishingly lovely.
You're slovenly, Frederick Garland, she stormed. Those bills have been waiting since Easter, and what have you done about it? What have you spent the money on? What do you ever do? But what do I do?
He turned back to her, his voice rising powerfully.
What do I do? I work harder than any band of painted mummers who loaf about in the back of a theatre. What about the polarizing lens? Do you think I got that by whistling for it? And the gelatin process? The devil take your bloody gelatin process! What do you mean, loaf? I will not have my work insulted by a second-rate daguerreotypist. His only idea of art is... Daguerreotypist? Second-rate? How dare you, you ranting puppet! Skulking bankrupt! Howling termagant!
And the next moment, he turned to Sally as calm as a bishop and said politely, Miss Lockhart... May I introduce my sister Rosa? Sally blinked and found herself smiling. The young woman held out her hand and smiled in return. Of course, they were brother and sister. He was nowhere near as good-looking as she was, but the sheer life and energy of expression was the same in each of them. Have I called it a bad time? She said. He laughed, and the little man came out from the counter like a tortoise out of its shell.
No, said Miss Garland, not at all. If you want to be photographed, you've just come in time. There might not be a business at all tomorrow.
She cast an angry glance at her brother, who waved it aside airily. No, I don't want to be photographed, said Sally. In fact, I only came because... Well, I met Mr. Garland last Friday, and...
Oh, you're the girl from Swale Ness. He told me all about it.
Can I go back to me plate now?
Said the little man.
Yes, go on, Trembler.
Said the photographer, seating himself calmly on the counter, as the little man touched his brow nervously and scuttled out. He's preparing some plates, you see, Miss Lockhart, and he got a little worried. My sister tried to assassinate me.
Someone ought to, she said darkly.
She's very excitable. She's an actress. Can't help it. I'm sorry to interrupt, said Sally. I shouldn't have come.
Are you in trouble?
Said Rosa. Sally nodded. But I don't want to...
Is it the witch again?
Said the photographer.
Yes, but...
She stopped. I wonder if I dare, she thought.
Did you say... I'm sorry, but I couldn't help hearing... Did you say you needed an accountant?
Well, so my sister tells me.
Of course we do, she said hotly. This photographic clown has got us into the most appalling muddle, and if we don't sort it out soon...
Exaggeration, he said. It won't take long to sort out.
Well, do it then, she flared at him. I can't, I haven't got the time, I haven't got the talent, and I certainly haven't got the inclination.
I was going to say, Sally went on diffidently, that I'm good with figures. I used to help my father draw up his company balance sheets, and he taught me all about bookkeeping and accounts. Well, I'd be glad to help. I mean, I came here to ask for help, but if I can do something in exchange, that would be better, perhaps. I don't know. She finished lamely, blushing. That speech had been difficult to make, but she was determined to get through it. She looked down.
"Do you mean it?" said the girl.
Honestly, I know I'm good with figures, or else I shouldn't have said anything.
Then we'd be delighted, said Frederick Garland. You see, he said to his sister, I told you there was nothing to worry about. Miss Lockhart, you'll join us for lunch.
Lunch, in their bohemian household, consisted of a jug of ale, the remains of a large joint of roast beef, a fruitcake, and a bag of apples, which Rosa said she had been given the night before by one of her admirers, a porter in Covent Garden Market. They ate it, with the help of one large pocket knife and their fingers, and empty chemical jars for the beer, at the crowded laboratory bench behind the shop. Sally was enchanted.
"You'll have to forgive her, miss, begging your pardon," said the little man,
whose only name seemed to be Trembler.
"It ain't want of breeding, it's want of money."
"But think what the rich are missing, Trembler," said Rosa. "Who'd ever discover how delicious beef and plum cake was unless they had nothing else to eat?"
"Oh, come on, Rosa," said Frederick. "We don't starve. We've never gone without a meal. We go without washing dishes, though," he said to Sally. "A matter of principle. No dishes, no washing."
Sally wondered how they managed with soup, but didn't have time to ask, for every gap in the conversation was filled by their questions, and by the time the meal was over they knew as much as she did about the mystery. Or mysteries.
"Right,"
said Frederick. And somehow, during the consumption of the plum cake, they had progressed to first-name terms without noticing it.
"Tell me this. Why don't you go to the police?"
"I don't really know. Or, yes, I do know. It's just that it seems to concern my birth, or my father's life in India, my background, anyway, and I want to keep that to myself, till I know more about it."
"Of course you do," said Rosa. "The police are so stupid, Fred. It's the last thing she should do."
"Well, you've been robbed," Frederick pointed out.
"Twice."
"I'd still rather not. There are so many reasons. I haven't even told the lawyer about being robbed."
"And now you've left home," said Rosa. "Where are you going to live?"
"I don't know. I must find a room."
"Well, that's easy. We've got acres of space. You can have Uncle Webster's room for the time being. Trembler will show you where it is. I've got to go and rehearse now. I'll be back later."
And before Sally could thank her, she had swept out.
"Are you sure?"
said Sally to Frederick.
"Well, of course. Never going to be businesslike. You can pay rent for it."
She thought of the tent and found herself confused, but he was looking away and writing something on a scrap of paper.
"Trembler,"
he said, "could you run across to Mr. Ely's and ask to borrow these books?"
"Righto, Mr. Fred, but there's them plates to be got up and the magnesium."
"Do them when you come back."
The little man left, and Sally said, "Is his name really Trembler?"
"His name is Theophilus Molloy, but honestly, could you call anyone Theophilus? I couldn't. And his previous associates used to call him Trembler. I suppose the name stuck. He's an unsuccessful pickpocket. I met him when he tried to pick mine. He was so relieved when I stopped him that he practically wept with gratitude, and he's been with us ever since. But look, I think you ought to read your newspaper. I see you have a copy of The Times. Have a look at page 6.
Sally, surprised, did as he said. Near the foot of the page she found a small paragraph which related the same news that Mr. Hopkins's rather brisker paper had told him the day before.
"Major Marchbank's dead," she said.
"I can't believe it. And this man, the one in the check suit, he was the one who stole the book, the one in the train. Do you think he'd just come from... Didn't he get in at Chatham, though? I certainly didn't see him at Swale Ness. Mrs. Holland must have got a message to him. And then last night he came back for the rest of it. He took my gun as well."
"Naturally he would, seeing it there, but you've got a copy of the papers. Let's have a look."
She opened her diary and passed it across the scarred deal top of the bench. He bent over it to read. "Place of darkness, under a knotted rope, 3 red lights shine clearly on the spot when the moon pulls on the water. Take it. It is clearly yours by my gift and by the laws of England. Antequem haec legis."
"Good Lord."
"What? Can you read the Latin? Don't you know what it says?"
"No. What is it?"
"It says, by the time you read this, I shall be dead. May my memory be... what's that word? May I be as swiftly forgotten." She felt suddenly cold. He knew what was going to happen, she said. Perhaps it wasn't murder, said Frederick. Perhaps it was suicide.
The poor man, said Sally. He was so unhappy.
She found tears in her eyes. It was that cold, bare house and the gentle way it had spoken to her. I'm sorry, she said. He shook his head and offered a clean handkerchief. When she had dried her tears, he said, He's talking about a hiding place, you realize. He's telling you where the ruby is and saying that it belongs to you. The laws of England. I thought that might mean treasure trove, but that belongs to the crown. Anyway, I can't work out what it all means. Nor can I. Yet. And then there's the opium smoker, Mr. Bedwell. In some way, he's easier to deal with. Ah, here's Trembler.
There you are, Mr. Fred, said Trembler, coming in with three large books. Can I do me plates now?
By all means.
Crockford's Clerical Directory. Bedwell. Bedwell.
Frederick flicked through the pages of a fat and solemn-looking volume until he found what he was looking for. Bedwell, the Reverend Nicholas Armbruster, born 1842, educated at Rugby, graduated M.A. from the University of Oxford 1864, curate of St. John's Summertown, Oxford.
They're twins, said Sally.
Exactly. I should think that if anyone can get this man out of Holland's lodgings, it'll be his own brother. We'll go to Oxford tomorrow and see him. During the rest of that day and evening, Sally learned a little about the Garland family. He was 21, she 18, and the house and shop belonged to their uncle, Webster Garland, who was, according to Frederick, the greatest photographer of the age. He was at present in Egypt, and Frederick was in charge with the result that had so enraged Rosa. Trembler told her all this while she sat in the back room and began to make sense of the accounts. Frederick went out at 3 o'clock to take some pictures at the British Museum, and Trembler became loquacious.
"He's an artist, miss, that's the trouble," he said. "There's plenty of money in the photography game for them as wants to make it, but Mr. Fred ain't interested in your portraits and your weddings. I've seen him spend a whole week sitting as still as a stone in one spot, waiting for the right light on a patch of water. He's good, mind you. But he will invent things, and it swallows the money at a rate you wouldn't believe. It's Miss Rosa what keeps this place afloat."
Rosa was an actress, as Frederick had said, at present playing in Dead or Alive at the Queen's Theatre. Only a tiny part, said Trembler, but she was bound to be a star one day. With those looks and that temperament, well, the world had no chance of resisting her. But so far the rewards were meagre, though her income was the greater part of the revenue of 45 Burton Street. "But Frederick's made quite a lot of money," said Sally, sorting through a pile of untidy receipts and scribbled bills, and putting income on one side, expenditure on the other. "In fact, there's quite a lot of money coming in, but it all seems to go out again."
"If you can see a way of keeping some of that cash in, miss, you'll be doing him the greatest favour as could be done, for he'll never manage it."
She worked on through the afternoon, gradually reducing the chaos of unpaid bills and tattered invoices to some sort of order. She enjoyed it immensely. Here at last was something she understood and could deal with, something with a clear and straightforward meaning. Trembler brought her a cup of tea at 5, and from time to time left the back room to serve a customer in the shop. "What do you sell most of?" Sally asked.
"Photographic plates and chemicals. He laid in a great store of stereoscopes, Mr. Fred, a few months back when he got some money for an invention, but they ain't selling. People want the pictures to go with him, and he's hardly got any of them."
"He ought to take some."
"You tell him, then. I've tried, but he won't listen to me."
"What sort do people like best?"
"Views is best. Stereoscopic views is different from ordinary ones. Then there's humorous, sentimental, romantic, devotional, and risky. Oh, and temperance, but he won't touch 'em. Says they're vulgar."
By the time Frederick came back at 6 o'clock, she had begun to make out a complete statement of their accounts, setting out precisely what they had earned and spent in the 6 months since Webster Garland had gone to Egypt.
"Formidable,"
he said cheerfully, setting down his camera and darkroom tent before shutting the shop door. "It'll take another day or so to get it completely straight," she said. "And you'll have to tell me what some of these notes say. Is it your writing?"
"Fred, it is. What does the whole thing look like, good or bad? Am I bankrupt?"
"You must press to have your bills paid on time. There's £56.07 owing to you from months ago, and 20 guineas from last month. If you get that in, you can pay most of what you owe. But you must do it properly and keep proper records."
"No time."
"You must make time. It's important."
"Too boring."
"Then pay someone to do it for you. It's got to be done, or you will be bankrupt."
"You don't need more money. You just need to manage what you've got. And I think I can find some ways of making more, in any case." "Would you like the job?"
"Me?" He was looking at her quite seriously. His eyes were green. She hadn't noticed that before.
"Why not?"
he said.
I don't know," she said. "I've done this today because, well, it needed to be done in exchange for your helping me to sort out. But, I mean, you need a professional advisor, someone who could, I don't know, sort of take charge of the business side altogether. Well, do you want to do it?"
She shook her head and then shrugged and found herself nodding and then shrugged again quickly. He laughed, and she blushed.
"Look," he said, "it seems to me that you're just the person for the job. You're going to have to get some sort of situation after all. You can't live on a tiny income. And do you want to be a governess?"
She shuddered.
"No. Or a nursemaid or a cook or something? Of course not. And you can do this. You seem to be good at it."
"I love doing it."
"Well, why do you hesitate?"
"All right, I will. I'll do it. And thank you."
They shook hands and agreed terms. She was to be paid at first by being given her board and lodging free. There was no money to pay her a wage until they earned some, as she pointed out. When the firm was making money, she would be paid 15 shillings a week. Once that was settled, Sally felt a glow of happiness, and to celebrate their agreement, Frederick sent out for a hot meat pie from the chop house around the corner. They cut it into four, saving a piece for Rosa, and sat around the laboratory bench to eat it. Trembler made some coffee, and as she drank it, Sally found herself wondering what it was that was so unusual about this household. There was something deeper than not washing dishes, than eating off a laboratory bench at odd hours. She puzzled over it as she sat in a sagging old armchair beside the fire in the kitchen, with Trembler reading the paper at the table, while Frederick whistled softly as he did something with chemicals in a corner. She still hadn't found the answer when, much later, Rosa came in, cold and noisy and triumphantly bearing a large pineapple, and woke Sally up, she having inadvertently fallen asleep, and stormed at the others for not showing her to her room. She was still puzzling when she climbed shivering into the narrow little bed and pulled the blankets up around her. But just before she fell asleep, she saw the answer. Of course, she thought. They don't think of Trembler as a servant. And they don't think of me as a girl. We're all equal. That's what's so odd. A Journey to Oxford. Mrs. Holland learned of the death of Henry Hopkins from one of her cronies, a woman who performed some dingy function in the workhouse of St. George's a street or two away. This woman had heard it from a factory girl in her lodgings, whose brother was a crossing sweeper who worked the same street as a news vendor whose cousin had spoken to the man who'd found the body. And in that way the news of criminal London spread from one place to another. Mrs. Holland was nearly speechless with rage at Hopkins's incompetence. To let himself be killed in that tame fashion. Of course, the police would never trace the killer, but Mrs. Holland intended to. The word went out, filtering like smoke through the alleys and courts, the streets and wharves and docksides. Mrs. Holland at Hangman's Wharf would give a good deal to know who'd killed Henry Hopkins. She sent out the word and waited. Something would turn up, and it wouldn't take long. There was one citizen who was feeling pursued by Mrs. Holland already, and that was Samuel Selby. Her letter took him completely by surprise.
He had thought that blackmail was impossible. The tracks had been well covered, and from Wapping, of all places. But after a day or so spent in quiet panic, he thought again. There were things in this letter that no one should have known about, true. But there were more incriminating things that weren't even mentioned. And where was the proof? Where were the invoices, the bills of lading, the ship's papers that would sink him? There wasn't a hint of them. No, he thought. Perhaps there's less to this than there seems. But I'd better make sure. Accordingly, he wrote a letter.
Samuel Selby, shipping agent, Cheapside. Tuesday, 29th of October, 1872. Mrs. M. Holland, Holland's Lodgings, Hangman's Wharf, Wapping. Dear Mrs. Holland, thank you for your communication of the 25th inst. I beg to inform you that your client's proposal is not without interest, and would like to invite your client to meet me at my office at 10 o'clock on the morning of Thursday the 31st. I beg to remain your humble servant, S. Selby.
There, he thought as he posted it, we'll see what that brings. He was inclined to doubt the existence of this client, this mysterious gentleman altogether. Dockside gossip, more like. Nothing more than that. Wednesday morning was cold, with a mist in the air. Frederick announced to Sally at breakfast, boiled eggs cooked in the kettle, that he would go to Oxford with her. He could always take some photographs, he said, and besides, she might need someone to keep her awake on the train, in case she fell asleep again. He spoke lightly, but she knew he meant she was in danger, and without her gun she felt vulnerable, and was glad of his company. The journey passed quickly. They were in Oxford by midday and had lunch at the railway hotel. Sally had talked easily on the train. Talking to Frederick and listening to him seemed the most natural and agreeable thing in the world, but she found herself, once seated facing him across a table set with cutlery and napkins and glasses, absurdly tongue-tied. "What are you scowling for?" he said at one point. She had been staring down at her plate, trying to think of something to say, and now she blushed. "I wasn't scowling," she said, sounding petulant and childish, and realizing it. He raised his eyebrows and said nothing more. The meal was not a success, in short, and they parted immediately afterwards, she to take a cab to St. John's Vicarage, and he to photograph some buildings. "Go carefully," he said as she left, and she wanted to go back and explain her silence at lunch, but it was too late. The vicarage of St. John's was about 2 miles from the centre of Oxford in the village of Summertown. The cab took her up the Banbury Road, past the newly built large brick villas of North Oxford. The vicarage was next to the church, in a quiet little road overhung with elm trees. The mist of the morning had cleared now, and a watery sun was shining faintly as Sally knocked at the door. "The vicar's away, but Mr. Bedwell's in, miss," said the maid who opened the door to her. "Through here, if you please, in the study." The Reverend Nicholas Bedwell was a stocky, fair-haired man with a humorous expression. His eyes widened as she came in, and she saw with surprise that his look was one of admiration. He offered her a chair and turned his own away from the desk to face her.
"Well, Miss Lockhart," he said jovially, "what can I do for you? Bands of a marriage?"
"I think I have some news of your brother," she said. He leapt to his feet, and a sudden excitement flooded his face.
"I knew it!" he cried, smacking his fist into his palm. "He's alive? Matthew's alive?" She nodded. "Tell me," he said, his blue eyes blazing. "Tell me all you know."
"He's in a lodging house in Wapping. He's been there about a week or 10 days, I suppose, and he's smoking opium. I don't think he can get away." The curate's face darkened at once, and he sank into his chair. Sally told him briefly of how she'd come to hear about it, and he listened intently, shaking his head as she came to the end.
"2 months ago I had a telegram," he said. "They told me he was dead, that his ship had gone down. The schooner Lavinia, he was the second mate."
"My father was on board," said Sally.
"Oh, my dear young lady," he exclaimed. "They said there were no survivors. He drowned. I'm so sorry." But you say you knew your brother was alive. We're twins, Miss Lockhart. All our lives we've each felt the other's emotions, known what the other was doing, and I was sure he wasn't dead. I was as certain of it as I am of this chair. He banged the arm of the chair he sat in. No doubt at all. But of course I didn't know where he was. You mentioned opium. That's probably why he can't get away. That drug is the invention of the devil. It's ruined more lives, wasted more fortunes, and poisoned more bodies even than alcohol. There are times, you know, when I'd willingly leave this parish and everything I've worked for and spend my life fighting against it. My brother became a slave to it 3 years ago in the East. I felt that, too. And unless it's stopped, unless he's stopped, it'll kill him, too, in the end. Sally was silent. The curate was staring fiercely into the cold fireplace, as if the ashes that lay there were those of the drug itself. His fists were clenching and unclenching slowly. Sally noticed that they were large and hard and thoroughly formidable. There was a certain battered quality about his face, too. His cheek was scarred, and his nose slightly flattened. Apart from the clothes he wore, he was most unclergyman-like. "But you see," she said after a moment, "your brother knows something about my father's death. He must do. The little girl said he'd got a message for me." He looked up suddenly. "Of course, I'm sorry. This concerns you too, doesn't it? Well, now, to business. We must get him out of that place as soon as possible. I can't leave the parish today, or tomorrow. Evensong this evening and a funeral tomorrow." He was leafing through a diary. "Friday's clear. Well, it isn't, but nothing I can't put off. There's a man at Balliol who'll take a service for me. We'll get Matthew out of there on Friday. But what about Mrs. Holland?" "What about her?" "Adelaide said she's keeping him prisoner, and it's the opium that's keeping him prisoner. This is England. You can't hold people against their will." His expression was so pugnacious that Sally feared for anyone who tried to stop him. "There's one thing, though," he went on more calmly. "He'll need some of that filthy drug to keep him going. I'll bring him back here and get him straight again, but without the drug he'll never manage. I'll have to wean him off it bit by bit." "How will you get him out?" "With my fists, if necessary. He'll come. But, look, could you do something for me? Could you find me some of the drug?" "I could try, of course I will. But wouldn't they sell it in Oxford, at a pharmacist's?" "Only in the form of laudanum, and the smoker needs the gum or the resin or whatever the evil stuff is. I hesitate to ask, but if you can't, we'll have to do without." "I can certainly try," she said. He put his hand in his pocket and drew out 3 sovereigns. "Take this, buy as much as you can, and if Matthew doesn't need it after all, then at least it's out of the hands of some other wretch." He came to the door with her and shook hands. "Thank you for coming," he said. "It's a great relief to know where he is. I'll come to your rooms at Burton Street on Friday, then. Expect me around noon." Sally walked back into Oxford to save the cab fare. The road was broad and pleasant, and busy with carts and carriages. These quiet houses and leafy gardens seemed to be on a different planet from the darkness and mystery and sudden death she was returning to. She passed one house where 3 young children, the eldest not much younger than she was, were building a bonfire in a cheerful, untidy garden. Their shouts and laughter made her feel cold and deprived. Where had her childhood gone? And yet only an hour or two earlier she had felt on fire with embarrassment because she was a child and had none of the ease of an adult. She would have given anything to be able to forget London and Mrs. Holland and the 7 blessings, and to live in one of these large, comfortable houses, with children and animals and bonfires and lessons and games. Perhaps even now it wasn't too late to become a governess or a nurse or... But it was. Her father had died, and something was wrong, and there was no one but her to set it right. She quickened her pace and entered the broad road of St. Giles's that led to the centre of the city. There was another hour and a half before she was going to meet Frederick.
She spent it in looking round the city, aimlessly at first, since the old college buildings had little interest for her. But then she saw a photographer's shop, and made for it at once. She spent an hour talking to the proprietor and looking at his stock, and came away much enlightened and much happier, having entirely forgotten, for a little while at least, Wapping and opium and the ruby.
"I knew I was right to come to Oxford," said Frederick in the train. "You'll never guess who I've been talking to this afternoon."
"Tell me then," said Sally.
"Well, I went to see an old school friend of mine at New College, and he introduced me to a chap called Chandra Sen, an Indian. He comes from Agrapur."
"Really?"
"He's a mathematician, very scientific, very austere, but we talked about cricket for a bit, and he loosened up, and I asked him what he knew about the ruby of Agrapur. He was astounded. Apparently there are more stories about that stone than just about any other piece of rock in India, and no one's seen it since the mutiny. The Maharaja was murdered, you know."
"When? By whom?"
"It was during that time, evidently, because his body was discovered after the relief of Lucknow. But no one knows who did it. And the ruby was missing, and it's never turned up since. But there was such confusion at that time, and so much death and destruction. He asked me how I'd heard of it, and I said I'd read something in an old book of travel. Then he told me something very odd. He didn't believe in this himself, far too rational, but there was a legend that the evil of the stone would persist until it was laid to rest by a woman who was its equal. I asked him what that meant, and he said rather sniffily that he had no idea, it was just superstition. Nice chap, but rather prim. Still, we've learned something, even if we don't know what it means."
Major Marchbanks said at the start of his book that the climax was, I forget his exact words, but horrible, I think he said.
"The murder of the Maharaja. Do you think he did it?"
"No. Impossible." She shook her head, and they fell silent for a while.
Then he said, "And what have you been finding out? You said at the station you had something to tell me."
With an effort, she tugged her mind away from India. "Stereographic pictures," she said. "I spent an hour or so in a photographer's shop. Do you know how many people came into the place while I was there and bought stereographic pictures? 6 of them in just 1 hour. Do you know how many have come into your shop and asked for them?"
"I haven't the vaguest idea."
"Trembler says more people ask for them than for anything else. And why buy all those stereoscopes if you don't sell the pictures to go in them?"
"But we sell stereographic cameras. People can take the pictures for themselves."
"They don't want to. Taking stereographs is a job for an expert. And anyway, people like pictures of far-off countries and things like that. Things they can't see for themselves."
"But people could buy them just as they buy books and magazines. They'd buy thousands."
"What sort of pictures did you take today?"
"I was trying a new Voigtlander 200mm lens with a variable diaphragm. I'm trying to get right."
"But what sort of pictures?"
"Oh, buildings and things."
"Well, you could take stereographs of places like Oxford and Cambridge and sell them as a set.
The colleges of Oxford, or the bridges of London, or famous castles. Honestly, Frederick, you could sell thousands."
He was scratching his head. His tow-coloured hair stood up stiffly, and his face, in the mobile, vivid way he shared with his sister, seemed to be struggling to contain 3 or 4 different expressions at once.
I don't know, he said. "I could take them easily enough. It's no more difficult than taking an ordinary photograph, but I couldn't sell them."
"I could, though."
"Ah, well, that's different. But photography's changing, you know. In a few years' time, we won't be using these great clumsy glass plates at all. We'll be taking negatives on paper in lightweight cameras. We'll be working at phenomenal speeds. There's all kinds of work going on. Well, I'm doing some of it myself. And no one will look at old-fashioned stereographs then.
But I'm talking about now. At the moment, people want them, and they'll pay you for them. And how can you do anything exciting in the future if you don't make some money now?"
"Well, you could be right." "Got any more ideas?"
"Lots. Display the goods differently, for a start. And advertise. And..." She stopped and gazed out of the window. The train was steaming along beside the Thames. The late autumn afternoon was closing in rapidly, and the river looked grey and cold.
This water would be flowing past Hangman's Wharf soon, she thought. We're both going that way.
What is it?
He said. Frederick, can you help me buy some opium? Madame Chang. Next afternoon, Frederick took Sally to the East End. The year before, he had helped his uncle in a project to photograph scenes of London life using an experimental magnesium light. The light had only been partly successful, but Frederick had made a number of acquaintances in the course of the project, including the proprietress of a limehouse opium den, a lady by the name of Madame Chang. Most of these places are abominable, he said as they sat in the omnibus. A shelf to lie on, a filthy blanket and a pipe, and that's all. But Madame Chang takes care of her customers and keeps the place clean. I suppose the reason is that she doesn't take the stuff herself. Are they always Chinese? Why doesn't the government stop them?
Because the government grows the stuff itself and sells it and makes a handsome profit.
Surely not.
Don't you know anything of history?
Well, no.
We fought a war 30 years ago over opium. The Chinese objected to English merchants smuggling opium into the country and tried to ban it, so we went to war and forced them to take it. They grow it in India, you see, under government supervision.
But that's horrible. And our government's still doing that now. I don't believe it.
You'd better ask Madame Chang. Time to get out now. We'll walk the rest of the way.
The omnibus had stopped at the West India Dock station. Beyond the gate into the dock, a line of warehouses stretched for over half a mile to the left, and above their roofs the masts of ships and the jibs of cranes pointed to the grey sky like skeletal fingers. They set off to the right, towards the river. They passed the large square dock offices where she supposed her father must have come many times on business, and then turned down an alley and into a maze of courts and side streets. Some of them were not even named, but Frederick knew the way and never hesitated. Barefoot children, ragged and filthy, played among the rubbish and the streams of stinking water that trickled thickly over the cobbles. Women standing in their doorways fell silent as they passed and stared with hostile eyes, arms folded until they had gone by. They looked so old, thought Sally. Even the children had pinched, old men's faces, with wrinkled brows and tight-drawn lips. Once they came on a group of men at the entrance to a narrow court. Some were leaning on the wall, some squatting on doorsteps. Their clothes were torn, clotted with dirt. Their eyes were full of hatred, and one of them stood up, and two others shifted away from the wall as Frederick and Sally approached, as if to challenge their right to pass. But Frederick did not change his pace. He walked straight up to the entrance, and the men drew aside at the last moment, looking away.
"Unemployed, poor fellows," said Frederick when they turned the corner. "It's either the street corner or the workhouse. And who'd choose the workhouse?"
"But there must be jobs on the ships or at the docks or something. People always want workers, don't they?"
"No, they don't. You know, Sally, there are things in London that make opium look no more harmful than tea."
She supposed he meant poverty, and as she looked around, she had to agree. Presently they came to a low wooden door set in the wall of a grimy alley. There was a sign beside the doorway with some Chinese characters painted in black on red. Frederick tugged the bell handle, and after a minute the door was opened by an old Chinaman. He was dressed in a loose black silk robe, and he had a skull cap and a pigtail. He bowed to them and stood aside as they entered. Sally looked around. They were in a hall lined with delicately painted wallpaper. All the wood was lacquered in a deep, lustrous red, and an ornate lantern hung from the ceiling. There was a close, sweet smell in the air. The servant left to come back after a moment with a middle-aged Chinese woman in a richly embroidered robe. Her hair was severely pinned back, and she had black silk trousers under the robe and red slippers on her tiny feet. She bowed and gestured towards an inner room.
"Please consent to enter my poor place of business," she said. Her voice was low and musical, and quite without any accent. "You, sir, are Mr. Frederick Garland, the photographic artist, but I have not been honoured with the acquaintance of your beautiful companion."
They entered the room. While Frederick explained who Sally was and what they wanted, Sally looked around in wonder. The light was very dim. Only two or three Chinese lanterns penetrated the smoky darkness. Everything that could be painted or lacquered in the room was the same deep blood red, and the doorposts and the beams of the ceiling were carved with curling, snarling dragons picked out in gold. It gave her a sense of oppressive richness. It seemed as if the room had taken on the shape of the collective dreams of all those who had ever gone there to seek oblivion. At intervals, around the walls, it was a large, long room, were low couches, and on each of them was lying a man, apparently asleep. But no, there was a woman, hardly older than Sally herself, and here another in middle age, respectably dressed too. And then one of the sleepers stirred, and the old servant hastened up with a long pipe and knelt on the floor to prepare it. Frederick and Madame Chang were speaking in low voices behind her. Sally looked for somewhere to sit. She felt dizzy. The smoke from the newly lit pipe drifted up to her, sweet and enticing and curious. She breathed in once, and then again, and
darkness, suddenly. Stifling heat. She was in the nightmare. She lay still, with her eyes wide open, searching the darkness. An enormous convulsive fear was squeezing her heart. She tried to move but could not, and yet it didn't feel as if she were bound. Her limbs were too weak to move. And she knew that only a moment earlier she'd been awake. But she was so afraid. The fear grew and grew. It was worse than ever this time, because it was so much clearer. She knew that any second, close to her in the darkness, a man would begin to scream, and she began to cry in pure fear of it. And then it started. The scream ripped through the darkness like a sharp sword. She thought she would die from fear. But voices were speaking. This was new, and they were not speaking in English, and yet she could understand them. "Where is it? Not with me, I pray. I beg of you. It is with a friend. They are coming. Be quick." And then a hideous sound, the sound of a sharp instrument sinking into meat, a sort of tearing sound, followed by a sudden gasp and groan as if all the breath had been forced out of a man's lungs at once, and then a gushing, splashing sound that quickly died away into a trickle. Light. There was a tiny spark of light somewhere. Oh, but she was awake. In the opium den, this was impossible. And she could not escape from the dream. It unwound ceaselessly, and she had to live through it. She knew what was coming next. A guttering candle. A man's voice.
"Look. Look at him. My God."
It was the voice of Major Marchbanks.
This was the point where she had always woken up before, but now something else happened. The light came closer and was held out to one side, and the face of a young man looked down at her, fierce, darkly moustached, with glittering eyes and a trickle of blood down his cheek. All at once she was awash with fear. She was almost mad with it. She thought, "I'm going to die. No one can be afraid like this and not die or go mad." There was a sharp blow on her cheek. She heard the sound of it a second later. Things were out of joint and everything was dark again. She felt a desolating sense of loss. And then she was awake. On her knees, her face streaming with tears, Frederick was kneeling beside her, and without thinking she flung her arms around his neck and sobbed. He held her tightly and said nothing. They were in the hall. When had she moved out there? Madame Chang stood a little way off, watching closely. When she saw that Sally was conscious again, the Chinese woman stepped forward and bowed.
"Please to sit on the divan, Miss Lockhart. Li Qing will bring some refreshment."
She clapped her hands. Frederick helped her onto the silk-covered divan, and the old servant offered her a little porcelain cup containing some hot, fragrant drink. She sipped it and felt her head clearing.
What happened? How long was I...
"You were affected by the smoke," said Frederick. "You must have inhaled more than you thought. But to go under all at once like that,
Isn't that very unusual, Madame Chang? This is not her first encounter with the smoke, said the lady, still standing motionlessly in the gloom. I've never smoked opium in my life, said Sally. It distresses me to contradict you, Miss Lockhart, but you have breathed the smoke before. I have seen 10,000 who have taken the smoke, and I know. What did you see in your vision? A scene that's come to me many times. A nightmare. A man is being killed, and two other men come along, and... What can it be, Madame Chang? Am I going mad? She shook her head. The power of the smoke is unbounded. It hides secrets of the past so well that the sharpest eyes in the brightest daylight would never find them. And then it reveals them all like buried treasure when they have been forgotten. What you saw is a memory, Miss Lockhart, not a dream.
How can you be sure it's not a fantasy? Said Frederick. Do you really mean to say that Sally's been under the influence of opium before, and that this nightmare of hers is a memory of the time when it happened? Isn't it possible that it's no more than a dream?
It is possible, Mr. Garland, but it is not what happened. I can see plainly what is invisible to you, just as a doctor can see plainly what is troubling his patient. There are 101 signs by which these things may be read, but if you cannot read them, you will see nothing.
Her still figure spoke out of the gloom like the priestess of some ancient cult, full of authority and wisdom. Sally felt the urge to weep again. She stood up. Thank you for explaining, Madame Chang, she said. Am I in danger from the drug? Now that I've taken it once, will I crave to take it again?
You have taken it twice, Miss Lockhart, said the lady. If you are in danger, it is not from the drug. But you have the smoke in your nature now. It has revealed something you did not know. Maybe you will crave the smoke, not for its own sake, but for the sake of what it can show you.
She bowed, and Frederick stood up to leave. Sally, who still felt dizzy, took the arm he offered, and after exchanging farewells, they left. Outside, it was nearly dark. The cold air was welcome to Sally, who breathed it in gratefully, and soon found the pounding in her head diminish a little. Before long, they were in the commercial road, and the bustle of traffic, the gas lights, the glowing shop windows, made the opium den seem like a dream itself. But she still trembled, and her sides and back were wet with perspiration. "Tell me about it," said Frederick. He hadn't spoken since they left the place. He seemed to know when she wanted silence. "I can trust him," she thought. So she told it all. But Frederick, the worst thing was... She faltered, and he said, "It's all right. You're safe now." But what was the worst thing? The man who spoke. I've heard his voice in my dreams so many times. But this time I recognized it. It was Major Marchbanks. And the man who looked down at me... Frederick, he was my father. What is it all about? What can it mean? The Stereographic Repertory Company. When they returned from Limehouse, Sally went straight to bed and slept dreamlessly for a long time. She woke just after dawn. The sky was clear and blue, all the horrors of opium and murder seemed to have vanished with the night, and she felt light-hearted and confident. Having dressed quickly and lit the kitchen fire, she decided to look over the rest of the house. Rosa herself had suggested this the morning before. They were wasting space, she thought. Perhaps there was room for a lodger. Sally thought that she was right. The house was much more extensive than it seemed from the street. There were three floors, together with an attic and a cellar, and a long yard behind the house. Two of the rooms were full of photographic apparatus, besides the dark room and the laboratory. The room beside the shop, on the ground floor, was fitted out as a studio for formal portraits. One of the upstairs rooms was filled with such a miscellaneous collection of things that Sally thought she'd stumbled into a museum. But there were two empty attic rooms, and three others which would make very comfortable bedrooms, once decently furnished. The result of this exploring was revealed to the rest of the household at breakfast. She cooked it, porridge this time, and very good too, she thought. "Frederick, are you busy this morning?" she said. "Inordinately, but it can wait." "Rosa, do you have to rehearse?" "Not till one. Why?" "And Trembler, can you spare some time?"
"I dunno, miss. I've got some processing to do."
"Well, it won't take long. I just wanted to tell you how to make some money."
"Well, for that," said Rosa, "you can have all the time you like. How do we do it?"
"It's something I thought about in Oxford the other day. I started to tell Frederick on the train."
"Hmm," he said. "Stereoscopes."
"Not the stereoscopes themselves, but the pictures for them. People are always wanting them. I looked at the rest of the house this morning, and I suddenly realized the kind of thing we could do. There's a room that's full of strange things. Spears and drums and idols and I don't know what."
"Uncle Webster's cabinet," said Rosa. "He's been collecting it for years."
"So that's one part of it," Sally went on. "The other is Rosa. Wouldn't it be possible to tell a story in pictures? With people, actors, in dramatic situations? Like a play, with scenery and things?" There was a little silence.
"Do you think they'd sell?" said Rosa.
"They'd sell like bleeding hot cakes," said Trembler. "Give me 1,000 and I'll sell them before dinner. Of course they'd sell."
"Advertising," said Sally. "We'd take a column in all the papers. Think of a clever name for them. I'd see to all that. That's easy. But what about making them?"
"Nothing to it," said Rosa. "It's a marvellous idea. You could take scenes from popular plays and sell them at the theatre."
"Songs," said Trembler. "Pictures to illustrate all the new songs at the music halls."
"With advertisements on the back," said Sally. "So we get paid extra for each one sold."
"Sally, it's a brilliant idea," said Rosa. "And with all those props
and the space outside to set up a real studio like an artist's, with room for scenery and sets and all kinds of things." They all looked at Frederick, who had not spoken. His expression was resigned. He spread his hands wide.
"What can I do?" he said. "Art, farewell."
"Oh, don't be silly," said Rosa. "Make an art out of this." He turned and looked at her. Sally thought, "They're like panthers, both of them. They're so alive and intense."
"You're right," he said suddenly, and banged the table. "I don't believe it," said Rosa. "Of course she's right, you foolish woman. I saw it at once, and we'll do it. But what about the debts?"
"Well, firstly, no one's actually pressing for money. We owe quite a lot, but if we can show that we're making an effort to pay, I think it'll be all right. Secondly, there are the accounts owing to us. I'm going to send off reminders this morning. And third, Rosa said something about lodgers. You've got room to spare, even with me here. That'll bring in a steady income, even if it's only a few shillings a week. And lastly, there's the stock. Frederick, I want you to go through it with me this morning, and we'll get rid of anything that's the slightest bit out of date or unnecessary. Have a sale. That'll raise some cash straight away to pay for the advertisements. Trembler, could you get started on the yard? We need a good clear space. And Rosa..." She became aware that they were all looking at her in some astonishment. Then Frederick smiled, and she felt a blush burning her cheeks. She looked down, confused.
"I'm sorry, I didn't mean to order you about. I thought... I don't know what I thought. I'm sorry."
"Nonsense! This is what we want," said Frederick. "We need a manager. That's what you are."
"I'll go and get on,"
said Trembler, leaving the table.
"And I'll wash the dishes," said Frederick.
"Just this once." He gathered them up and left. Rosa said, "You know, you're two quite different people."
"Am I?"
"When you're taking charge, you're so strong."
"Me?"
"And when you're not, you're so quiet you hardly seem to be there."
"How awful. Am I very bossy? I don't mean to be."
No, I don't mean that at all. It's just that you seem to know just what to do, and neither Fred nor I have any idea. It's marvellous. Rosa, I know so little. I don't even know how to talk to people, and what I do know is so... I don't know how to put it. It's just not the sort of thing that girls know. I love doing this. I can't tell you how much I love it, but it's not... I feel guilty somehow, as if I should be normal and know all about sewing and things. Rosa laughed. She was magnificent. The sunlight seemed to break over her hair like surf over a rock, shattering into thousands of glowing fragments. Normal, she said. What do you think I am? An actress, little better than a streetwalker. My parents threw me out because of what I wanted to do, and I've never been so happy. Just like you. They threw you out? But what about Frederick and your uncle? Fred had an awful row with them. They wanted him to go to university and all that sort of thing. My father's a bishop. It was horrid. Uncle Webster's a sort of old reprobate, anyway. They don't acknowledge him. But he doesn't care a bit. Fred's been working with him for 3 years. He's a genius. They both are. Sally, have you ever done wrong? Sally blinked. I don't think so. Then don't feel guilty. All right? All right. All right, I won't. If you're good at something, you must do it. Right. Rosa jumped up. Let's go and sort out those props. I haven't looked in there for ages. They worked all morning, and Trembler, fired by the general enthusiasm, sold a stereoscope to a customer who had only called in to book a portrait sitting. Finally, at 12 o'clock, the Reverend Bedwell arrived. Sally was behind the counter at the time, writing reminders to people who owed them money. She looked up to see the stocky figure of the curate of St. John's, and at first didn't recognise him, for he was dressed in a rough old tweed coat and corduroy trousers, without a clerical collar. In fact, he didn't have a collar at all, and he hadn't shaved. So complete was the transformation, from mild curate to sullen ruffian, that Sally was almost prompted to ask him to act in a stereoscope play. "I do beg your pardon," he said. "Hardly the right sort of clothes to pay a call in. My parson's garb is in a portmanteau in the left luggage office at Paddington. I only hope I can find an empty compartment on the way back. I can hardly return to the vicarage like this." Rosa came in and was introduced, and promptly invited him to stay for lunch. He took one look at her and accepted at once. Soon they were all seated, and while they ate the bread and cheese and soup Rosa had set out, he explained what he intended to do. "I shall take a cab to Hangman's Wharf and drag him out by the collar. He won't resist, but Mrs. Holland might. Anyway, I'll bring him here, if I may, so that Miss Lockhart can learn what he has to say, and then we'll go back to Oxford."
"I'll come with you," said Sally.
"No, you won't," he said. "He's in danger, and so would you be if you went anywhere near that woman."
"I'll come," said Frederick.
"Splendid. Have you ever boxed?"
"No, but I used to fence at school. Are you expecting a fight?"
"That's why I'm dressed like this. Embarrassing to start swinging your fists if you're a man of the cloth. The fact is, I don't know what to expect."
"There's a cutlass in the cabinet," said Rosa. "Do you want to take that? And perhaps I ought to make you up as a pirate, Fred. A patch over one eye and thick black whiskers, and then we could stereo-eyes you both."
"I'll go as I am," said Frederick. "If I want whiskers, I'll grow them."
"Is your brother really identical?" said Rosa.
"I've met some identical twins, but they were terribly disappointing."
"Utterly indistinguishable, Miss Garland, apart from the opium. And who knows? If I'd been tempted in that way, I might have fallen as he did. But what's the time? We must be going. Thank you for the luncheon. We'll be back sometime later."
He left with Frederick, and Rosa sat thoughtfully for a minute.
"Identical twins," she said. "What an opportunity. Good grief, is that really the time? I'll be late. Mr. Toole will be furious."
Mr. Toole was the actor-manager she was rehearsing with, and apparently a stickler for all kinds of rules. She threw on her cloak and left quickly. Trembler went back to the yard, leaving Sally on her own. The house was suddenly quiet and empty. Mr. Bedwell had left a newspaper. and she picked it up, intending to look at the advertisements. She saw that a firm called